Many people deemed essential workers feel like they're having to choose between taking care of themselves and making ends meet.
You've got rent to pay, you've got the gas bill, so you're stuck. You have to go into work and expose yourself to risk.
We're talking about airline workers today, part of our ongoing series of conversations about the COVID economy. Plus, as we continue to practice social distancing, isolation and loneliness are affecting many, especially seniors. We'll hear more about how one retirement community is keeping their residents connected through technology. And adopting pets and sewing masks, we'll talk about some of the ways people are trying to do good during the pandemic. I'm Brian Mackey. That's coming up this hour on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Illinois is approaching 25,000 known cases of COVID-19. That's according to the latest numbers as we go to air Thursday morning. The Illinois Department of Public Health is also reporting 80 new deaths, bringing the state's total to 948. Before we get to today's show, I want to mention that yesterday, Wednesday, we had two conversations about Illinois state finances, one with Comptroller Susanna Mendoza, the other with two experts from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. A few hours after we went to air, Governor J.B. Pritzker's administration released new estimates of how much income and sales tax money Illinois could lose on account of the coronavirus pandemic. Very roughly, it could be a hole of $6 to $7 billion through the summer of 2021. That's in line with one of the projections we talked about yesterday, and it would be on par with the hit Illinois took from the Great Recession, but that could be an optimistic scenario. You can hear our conversation on our podcast feeds or on our website, 21stshow.org. They're still worth a listen. Later this hour, we'll hear how a retirement community is keeping its residents connected through technology during this time of social distancing, and we'll talk about some of the ways that people are trying to help out during the pandemic, whether it's sewing masks or adopting pets. But first, when we talk about people on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic, doctors, nurses, other healthcare workers rightly come to mind. But the country's transportation workers are also performing essential jobs, sometimes putting their lives at risk. At least three JetBlue employees passed away from complications related to COVID-19. Hundreds of airline workers have tested positive, and at least one worker with American Airlines also succumbed to complications from coronavirus disease. Earlier today, I spoke with a Central Illinois airline worker. He wanted to remain anonymous because he feared repercussions from his employer for speaking to the press, but we did verify his identity. What are your concerns as an airline worker when it comes to COVID-19?
It's highly contagious, and it's come to light that it's highly contagious when people are asymptomatic. We're seeing people that are transiting through major hubs, from one point to another. So you get someone who goes from L.A. to Detroit and then downstate or something along those lines. They've been in contact with how many people? An aircraft is a confined space, and the guidance that the companies, airlines, have gotten from CDC is that unless you're symptomatic, you're still required to report to work as an essential worker. So, yeah, you're putting yourself at risk, you're putting coworkers at risk, you're putting your family members at risk.
I understand you work out of an airport in Central Illinois, and some people might say the risk is lower there than in other places like Chicago. And what would you say to that?
Well, so I do work downstate. So you get someone come through O'Hare and they've been in close contact with how many people? And then now they're down here and they're in close contact with other people. So we, just because you are in a downstate community, such as Carbondale, for example, or Bloomington or Champaign or wherever it may be, that does not mean that you're not exposed if they're coming through O'Hare or Detroit or Memphis. It's like a domino effect.
And what steps would you like to see your employer take to ensure your safety?
They've actually taken quite a few steps. The thing is, you're dependent upon your coworkers and your other community members following that same guidance. I cannot tell you how many grocery stores or pharmacies or whatever I've seen. The mask wearing down in downstate is, I would guess, in the low 10%. Very rare to see them. I mean, you see them, but not often. So if I go in and I'm gloved up and masked up, but three or four of my coworkers aren't, defeats the whole purpose. So they need to enforce that guidance much harder than they are, in my opinion. Even at the governmental level, it is scary because a person needs a paycheck every week. And when you're designated essential worker, depending on what state you live in, of course, you know, if you just quit and go home and self-quarantine and hide out, you might not qualify for unemployment. So, and you got to eat, you've got rent to pay, you've got the gas bill, you've got the phone bill. You know, these guys aren't going to wait forever, so you're stuck. You have to go into work and expose yourself to risk, potentially bring it home to your family. I mean, I felt terrible. My daughter asked me for a hug, and there was a brief moment where I thought, is it wise to hug her? And people shouldn't have to live like that.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Have a good day and stay safe out there.
Thank you. You as well.
Joining us now to talk more about the risks that airline workers have been facing during the pandemic is Tom McDaniel. He worked as a Southwest Airlines flight attendant for decades. Now he's the International Vice President of the Transport Workers Union, which represents more than 150,000 airline, railroad, and transit workers across the country. And a reminder that if you want to join the conversation, if you are an airline worker or some other sort of transportation worker yourself, we'd love to hear what you are facing out there in the world during this pandemic. Give us a call, 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. Tom McDaniel, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So we just heard from an airline worker in Central Illinois. I'm wondering, what's your reaction to what he said?
Well, he's absolutely right. Our airline workers are considered essential employees. And when they're at work, they need to, we understand that a lot of the airlines are saying that they're going by CDC guidelines. We're asking them to go over and above and consider the very one-to-one work that we do with airline customers and make sure that we have every kind of protection that we can to keep the transportation industry going.
So earlier we mentioned that some JetBlue employees have died of COVID-19. Also, I think an American Airlines employee. We've seen hundreds more test positive across many different companies. Which airlines does your union represent?
We do represent JetBlue. We also, as far as flight attendants go, we also represent the Southwest flight attendants, FSI flight attendants, and Allegiant flight attendants. And we represent the ground workers at American and at Southwest. And we also represent mechanics, as well as some dispatch workers and other trainers and things like that at other airlines. But it's mainly those three.
Okay. So, you know, I think we tend to think, as I said earlier, we tend to think of hospital workers as the one being on the front lines of this pandemic, and they certainly are. But, you know, flight attendants are often referred to as first responders in the sky. What are some of the risks that they have faced with COVID-19?
Well, we very definitely are first responders in the sky. We were the ones who lobbied to even be able to get the flight attendants to be able to wear gloves and masks on the aircraft. We've lobbied to get some changes, but some of the airlines are still requiring the flight attendants to clean up the planes between flights. We believe that work should be done by qualified people who have the proper equipment to clean the planes, and we believe that it should be done not only on overnights, but it should be done between every flight. But a lot of the risks that they face are the fact that, as the gentleman mentioned earlier, you come into contact with somebody and you're considered, you know, when you're asymptomatic, then they don't really notify people until long after they've been exposed.
And what about other airline workers, like people handling bags, for example?
It's a huge concern for them also. The people who are boarding the plane, the people who are working in the airports, we're still coming in contact with people. And even though the loads are significantly lower at this time, we're still working one-on-one. We have our baggage handlers who are handling the baggage. And you know, I know flight attendants who, once they go home from a trip, they won't even bring their suitcase into the house because they're afraid of exposing their family members.
So do you think that the industry or the government responded in a timely enough manner to the pandemic, at least when it came to protecting people in your industry?
Well, absolutely not. It didn't happen quickly enough, and it's not happening widely enough. I know that I listened to a radio broadcast yesterday, and the gentleman from Illinois was talking about, you know, what the risks are. But one, you know, your neighboring state, Iowa, is not even under a stay-at-home order. And obviously, we know that people come into Illinois from Iowa to fly, and there needs to be a nationwide response to this, a nationwide plan, and the industry should take it even further since we are essential employees.
So I think you mentioned that flight attendants can now wear gloves and masks in the plane. Are there other steps that you have seen the airlines taking to try and protect workers?
Well, yes, there are. And let me point out that the flight attendants are allowed to wear gloves and masks. But from the very beginning, the companies, the airlines' reaction to that was, you can wear masks, but we can't provide them for you at this time. So you need to supply your own, which is, of course, an additional burden. We're having a hard time getting both gloves and masks to the point that our union is looking to get them for our members everywhere that we can. And we're trying to supply those. But we believe that the company should be supplying those for everybody. But the other steps that we've been taking is we've been able to lobby successfully through the FAA to get changes in social distancing on the aircraft. We've also gotten them to agree that when two flight attendants are sitting next to each other on a jump seat, for takeoff and landing, they would normally sit right next to each other, that one of them can take an alternate passenger seat so that they're not exposed to each other and they can have proper social distancing. Most of the airlines are not requiring service at this time. And like I said, one of the big pushes that TWU is doing right now is we're trying to eliminate the requirement of the flight attendants to have to clean the aircraft between flights.
You know, I'm trying to imagine what social distancing looks like in such a confined space like an aircraft cabin. Can you paint a picture of that for me?
Well, if you've been on an airplane recently.
I haven't. No, I mean, they've been pretty... Okay, so it's that sparse right now.
Well, it can be that sparse. One thing that we are finding with the loads right now, you know, in the beginning of this, the loads were very, very light. Now that they're canceling a lot of flights and combining the loads, you can find some flights that have people further away. So some things that the airlines have done is they've cordoned off a couple of rows of seats at the front and the back of the aircraft, or where the jump seats are located, so that the passengers aren't seated immediately adjacent to the flight attendants. And they've also, whenever they are seating people, the airlines that have seating assignments are trying to scatter them throughout the cabin. The passengers who have open seating, for instance, are recommending that people seat themselves, further away than they probably normally would.
But services are still continuing, right? Drinks and food services, if airlines offer that?
As far as I know, not at all. I know that Southwest and JetBlue have both discontinued that. And it's, you know, it's just basically what we're trying to prevent is we're trying to prevent customer contact, person-to-person contact.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So more of a bare bones experience right now, I guess. So we mentioned
it,
that.
It is.
And, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it is. And, you know, that's not the kind of service that we want to provide. And that's not the kind of service that people are used to. But this is a, you know, it's a time when we have to go that extra mile and we have to say the best thing that we can do for you today is not to serve you a drink.
So you mentioned that, you know, flights were, they were sparse, attendance or how do you say it? Bookings were sparse. They're being combined now. Flights are being canceled. I imagine a lot of workers are concerned about their job, or maybe some have already been told to stay home. When it comes to economic help for workers in the airline industry, what would you like to see?
Well, of course, the CARES Act was very important, and we supported that because it provides direct compensation and wage guarantees for airline workers. Some of the airlines are offering unpaid leaves. Some of them are offering paid leaves that have a very minimal pay component to them. We're still working that out with some people. But, you know, it is. It's a huge stress on everybody because it's an incredible burden on any worker when they have to decide between protecting their family's health and protecting their income income and the roof that's over their head. I mean, this could mean if we don't work through this and if we don't find a way to get to the other side and do that with the workers first, then there are going to be people who are devastated.
So we have just a couple of minutes left in our conversation here, but you've worked as a flight attendant for many years. I wonder, have you ever experienced a time like this in the industry?
No, never. There's never been anything like this. It's unprecedented. The only thing that we can take this back, I was the president of a union at Southwest Airlines on 9/11, and which was an incredibly tragic thing. And but everyone, we had an immediate response to that. And the airplanes were on the ground for 4 days. The skies were closed, but everybody was working in the same direction, and there was very clear direction about what we needed to do to get back to some semblance of normal. And with 9/11, once 9/11 happened and once we got a hold of that, everything got better every day. Now, with a lot of the uncertainty, things are actually getting worse every day.
And just about 30 seconds left, but do you think, we saw permanent changes in airline travel after 9/11, especially when it comes to security. Do you think there will be permanent changes resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, I think there need to be permanent changes in the way that the entire country and maybe even the world handles things like this. There needs to be a plan for what happens whenever you have some kind of a disease or some kind of a virus or a potential pandemic. It should never get to the point of being pandemic, because we should be proactive, and that should go everywhere from the person who gets you to work every day when you take the bus to the flight attendant or the baggage handler or the customer service agent at the aircraft. They should have the proper protections that they need to handle anything like this, and there should be a nationwide plan and response in the future.
Tom McDaniel is International Vice President of the Transport Workers Union of America. Tom, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, great. Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. More after a short break. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. It's more crucial now than ever that the elderly stay away from others as the coronavirus pandemic and the stay-at-home orders continue. But a lack of connection and loss of routine can amplify feelings of loneliness and isolation for senior citizens, a group that's already one of the most susceptible to those feelings. One way many people have started to connect during the coronavirus pandemic is through technology, social media, video chat. But some older people are not comfortable navigating new technologies, or they may just not have access to smartphones or even broadband internet. Kathleen Cagney is now with us. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. I'm also joined on the line by Karen Blatzer, who's the director of marketing at Clark Lindsay, a not-for-profit retirement community in Urbana. Kathleen and Karen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
And if you out there have been helping an older friend or relative stay connected, or maybe if you're an older person looking to keep in touch, you can join our conversation anytime, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21STShow. That's 21st Show. Karen, before social distancing and the stay-at-home order was in place, can you just take us through what socialization and group activities were available at Clark Lindsay? What would a typical day look like for residents?
Sure. At Clark Lindsay, we have about 250 independent living residents, and we have several different kinds of activities and programs. At Clark Lindsay, it's real important for all of us, for all of our programming, to revolve around the four components of well-being. So that's social, intellectual, physical, and spiritual. As human beings, we all need these four components of well-being incorporated into our life. And when we have them on a daily basis, we tend to be happier and we live longer. So all of our programming has to do with that. So there's, we have a large wellness center. We have an indoor swimming pool, fitness center. We have all different kinds of resident-led group activities, everything from knitting to book clubs to conversation groups about war and all different kinds of topics. We really just had just so many things. It's a very vibrant community, a lot of hustle and bustle, very active people. A lot of our residents are not only active at Clark Lindsay, but outside in our community, volunteering and serving as mentors, and they're just a really great group of people.
And what, you know, one of our producers is suggesting she would like to live at Clark Lindsay. It sounds pretty good. I imagine a lot of those activities are on hold now. And if that's the case, what's it
right.
been like for people to go from 60 to zero, so to speak?
Yeah. All of our activities and programming for outside the community as well as in the community have been postponed. And so now we're really going virtual with most of our activities. And when you were mentioning about older adults that maybe they don't have the opportunity to engage in technology or they don't know enough about using it, that's one of the really great things about living in a retirement community like Clark Lindsay, because we have the resources. We even have a tech specialist with our residents, and we have iPads available. So some of the things that we're doing right now, we have a resident portal that we've had for a long time, but I can tell you honestly, not all of our residents were engaged in it. But now that this is a means of communicating with other people, now it's really been a great way to connect with other people. I'm sorry, I do have a screaming child here. Let me just walk.
Oh, no, that's all right. I live in fear of that happening every minute of this live show from my own house. That's okay. Kathleen, I'd like to bring you into the conversation now. And I think as we just heard there, most of us, if not all of us, have had our day-to-day lives upended to some extent by the coronavirus. And I wonder, how has the pandemic affected our ability specifically to connect with other people, and especially with older adults?
Well, I think one of the ways that the pandemic differs from other sorts of crises we've experienced, like Superstorm Sandy or heat waves, Hurricane Katrina, is that they're both short in duration, and you're not putting someone at risk by being in contact with them physically. And so it's really hard because the form of interaction people need to some degree is based on that face-to-face interaction. So we have to find ways both to supplant that and also to think about this as a long-term form of support. So I think in those kinds of crises that I mentioned, there's a sense that things will improve relatively quickly and that the social and physical structures will be in place. But I think we know right now in this pandemic that we're going to need one another for a longer period of time.
Kathleen, why are senior citizens so susceptible to feelings of isolation and loneliness, even outside of a pandemic?
Well, social contacts tend to decrease as we age, and that can be due to retirement, the death of friends and family, or lack of physical mobility, which just means we can't get out and about so easily. So that really puts older adults at risk. And research suggests that isolation and loneliness are linked to other kinds of physical outcomes like high blood pressure, obesity, heart disease, and more generally a weakened immune system. And that can then lead to other sorts of outcomes like depression, anxiety, or cognitive decline.
And Kathleen, you've been looking at some of the health outcomes mm-hmm. when loneliness in older populations does not get addressed. I think it can even manifest itself in physical health problems as well. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So that is where we see these higher rates of chronic conditions like diabetes. You see much higher rates of frailty, higher rates of falls, which then can lead to other kinds of physical health difficulties. And it's certainly lots of research suggests that reports of loneliness lead to early death. In our study, the National Social Life Health and Aging Project, we find that about 30% of our respondents report that they're lonely some of the time, and 8% of the respondents say they're severely lonely. So that's during times of regular social interaction, not during times of crisis.
And Karen, I know Clark Lindsay is using different technologies to help residents. You mentioned that a minute ago. I want to talk a little bit more about that later in our conversation.
Sure.
But I wanted to ask about what Kathleen just said about that loneliness and isolation. Is that a concern for your residents now and always? Do you think they're feeling the effects of social distancing?
It's definitely a concern. We've been doing regular phone calls a couple times a week with our residents. So there's been several of us that were identified and were assigned certain residents. And so I'm making those phone calls a couple times a week. And actually, it's turned out to be the highlight of my whole work week, actually, just calling them up and seeing how they're doing. And everybody really has a very positive, a positive attitude, but they've all said they're very grateful to all the different steps that we're taking at Clark Lindsay to keep them safe. And I think that safety and that security and knowing that we're out there to connect with them, I think that makes them feel more optimistic about everything.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. We've been speaking with Karen Blatzer, who's the Director of Marketing for the Urbana Retirement Community, Clark Lindsay. Kathleen Cagney is also with us. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. We're talking about the toll that isolation and social distancing during the coronavirus pandemic can take on older adults, the elderly. As always, we'd love to have you join our conversation. How have you been staying connected with an older friend or relative? Or maybe you're an older person looking to keep in touch. Join the conversation, 800-222-9455. That number is 800-222-9455. Karen, can you tell us a little bit more about some of the ways that Clark Lindsay has been using technology to connect to residents?
Sure, absolutely. In our residence apartments, they all have Channel 2, which is the Clark Lindsay TV channel. And so we've been able to bring them exercise videos from our fitness coordinator. She has recorded some exercises in one of our guest suites. So it makes it look like she's in her home and she's doing these exercises, and residents can also do it from their homes. So they get some physical fitness. We've also been getting lots of wonderful cards and notes and children's artwork from the community, and we've put those into a video that we stream on this channel too. We also have pictures of our residents and staff with quotes from them, positive quotes. One of our residents, actually some of them are funny, one of our residents put, I hope I recognize my Clark Lindsay friends in a couple of months without a visit to their beauty or barbershop. we're also asking some thought-provoking questions to our residents. We gave them a whole list of different thought-provoking questions, and then we'll get their answers on Channel 2. So some of those questions could be, you know, what musical instrument makes you feel the happiest? What was your biggest surprise of your life? You know, what was the best advice you've ever received? And so this will be a fun way of connecting, too. So that's our TV channel. We also have a resident portal that we kicked off in the fall. And it's just supposed to be a really easy way for residents to get the information and to connect with others. So it's easy to log on. There's announcements at the very top, everything from the latest news on COVID-19 to links to fun activities like virtual tours at pretty much any museum that you'd want. So let's say you want to go to the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, and you can navigate a virtual tour. You can visit many zoos. The San Diego Zoo has live feeds. I can watch the elephants or the penguins. And then there's also a library of workout videos on the portal as well. The thing about our portals, like I said, we kicked it off in the fall. There were some residents who took to it right away, but there were a lot of residents who really didn't have a lot of interest in it. And now that has changed entirely. Mm-hmm. Now there's a desire to learn about this resident portal because they want to connect with others. And this is really the main way to do it.
Sure.
So we've seen a big increase.
Yeah. Kathleen, I want to bring you back into the conversation. So for people maybe who don't have access to closed circuit television in a retirement community, what are some of the other ways that we can connect with older people, either technologically or otherwise?
Yeah, I think many of the things that Karen's describing are sound amazing to me and really essential. But I think it's also important to remember that about 29% of those 65 and older are still living in the community and living alone. And about half of older women are living on their own in particular. And so so I think it's important to imagine how the community can provide infrastructure and support for those individuals. And so, you know, some of the things are just kind of, you know, sound more old fashioned, but getting people's phone numbers and calling them every day. And, you know, there have been these processes in community for a long period of time, which are really information chains, where one neighbor calls another neighbor, calls another neighbor to share information and resources. And so something like that, that people can count on again each and every day, I think is effective. I also think, you know, we can make a decision in our own communities to make certain that we know who is vulnerable in our community and to check on those 2 to 3 people again on a regular basis to make sure that they have food and other sorts of social and physical supports.
It seems like as communication, I mean, you mentioned phone trees, mm-hmm. I think is what we used to call
exactly.
that, but
mm-hmm.
that's all going on to Facebook now or text message chains or things like that. I mean, does that infrastructure still exist in neighborhoods?
Yes, I think it does.
Okay.
I think it might. And to the extent that it doesn't, I think we should recreate it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a really rich literature, again, thinking back on other types of crises in community where neighborhoods that have high rates of trust and solidarity, where people know one another and feel that their neighbors have their back, if you will, those are communities that both are more effective in times of crisis and also rebuild more quickly. And so you have to sort of draw on that reservoir, if you will, to make certain that the more vulnerable persons in your neighborhoods are okay.
And Karen, you mentioned at Clark Lindsay, the, you know, using this television channel to connect within the people within the facility there, but what about connecting with families outside? Are you able to provide tech support for that? And we've only got about a couple of minutes left in our conversation here.
Oh, sure. Yeah, Zoom has been really, really popular. We've been using it internally for playing bingo, Trivial Pursuit, and Scattergories, but also to connect with family members. And they've been able to dine with their family members or have birthday parties with their family members. So that's really been nice. And I also wanted to touch upon the community aspect. You know, as a nonprofit, Clark Lindsay has a responsibility to give back to the greater community. We have a monthly luncheon called Ethel and Maud's, where we have live entertainment and a very reasonable price luncheon. And that has been put on hold. However, now we're finding other ways to reach out to the community. So we just celebrated our 6th anniversary yesterday, went on Facebook Live and had people connecting and did some trivia. We're also looking at ways where we can still provide those meals to people in our community, as well as live entertainment. It's just really important for all older adults to have that connection on any level possible.
And Kathleen, last question to you, I think. Do you have a suggestion? Is there something people can do right now, this afternoon, after the show today, about, you know, to try and connect with someone either in their neighborhood, in their family? I mean, just to try and bridge this gap that's out there.
Yeah, I think take a walk, if you can, around the neighborhood and try to identify someone who you think may be in need and slip a note under the door. Or if you already have information, like contact information for that individual, a phone number, call that individual. I think, I you know, in other analyses we've done, I think, you know, that's a task that we can engage in right now. That's a doable number. And I think, you know, one important idea to keep in mind is that if we create that sort of connectedness, it's going to be there the next time we are in need. And again, it's back to this notion of creating a reservoir so that in times of crisis, again, we have something to draw upon.
Kathleen Cagney is a professor of sociology at the University of Chicago. We also spoke with Karen Blatzer, who's director of marketing for the Urbana Retirement Community, Clark Lindsay. Both of you, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Brian.
More to come on the 21st. We're going to be taking a look at some of the ways people are trying to contribute to the fight against COVID-19. That's coming up just after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. With the ever-growing case numbers and death toll from COVID-19, and the order of the day being to stay at home, people are looking for ways to do something, anything, to contribute to the cause. For some, that's showing support for essential workers. Is the sound of people cheering in Chicago's South Loop neighborhood, honking, blinking the lights of their apartments on their balconies to honor healthcare workers and first responders. Other Illinoisans are heading to their sewing machines to make masks. One of those people is Jean Huddleston of Champaign, and she joins us on the line now. Jean, welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the call.
If you or you'd like to tell us about someone else who's doing something special for first responders or healthcare workers during this segment, you can give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. Jean, I understand that you and a friend have made more than 800 masks in just a few weeks. How'd you get started with that?
Well, my friend is Cindy Cook. She's the one who is helping me. We saw that Carl had put out an ask for masks for the hospital. So she and I started there. And then I had a neighbor who's a social worker who works with the elderly. The company she works for did not have masks. And so they're going into all of these homes. So I made masks for her. And then I also volunteer with Carl Hospice. And then all of a sudden they needed masks. And then, and then friends of mine would want masks. I had an aunt who lives up in the Chicago area. Her and her husband asked for a mask. A friend of mine's daughter works in the ER in Elgin, Illinois, and they have a hard time getting masks. So I've sent one batch up there, and I'm making another batch to go up there. And where I work one day a week out there at Candlewood Estates, I made them masks because they do have contact with a lot of people. And so it's been a mixed bag of things. Also, I got involved with CU Mask Makers, which if anybody's interested in making masks would be a great place to go into because they have a spreadsheet that says where in town needs masks. It's like Cunningham, Carl, OSF, and different places around town that have a real need. So, yeah, if you're bored and have materials, or they will help provide some of the materials, that would also be a good resource for people to go to.
Sure. So for people outside the area, Carl is, of course, one of the big hospitals there in Champaign-Urbana. So how long does it take to make a mask? I mean, you went from, it sounded like, just a few to 800 in a few weeks. That's
right.
That's quite the production.
You can crank out one in 20 minutes. It's
wow.
A very simple pattern. Carl on their website has a pattern. And it's easy and it's quick. The hardest thing about the whole thing is find an elastic. And if you can't find elastic, you can put ties on them. But it's a very quick thing. I will cut out like 25 of them and then, do it just sew them up. And then I've got those done and then I'll do another batch.
So we're talking to Jean Huddleston of Champaign, who, along with her friend, has sewed more than 800 masks for first responders all over Illinois as well as Florida. If you or you'd like to tell us about someone who's doing something special for first responders or healthcare workers during this segment, you can call us 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So, Jean, I understand you're retired from Krannert Center in Urbana.
Yes.
Have you done anything like this before?
I haven't made masks before, but I got into a thing where if you had a loved one who died, I would make teddy bears out of their clothes. And I do that with Carl Hospice also. So, and that's been, I believe in giving back. I think it's important to give back. So I didn't know I was a sewer until I retired.
Oh, so you didn't work in the costume shop or anything like that?
I was director of business and operations, you know,
okay.
30 years. So, yeah, no, I had no knowledge that I had any talent at all. So, and it just, you know, it was want to do and a way to give back. My friend Cindy says equates making the mask to World War II rolling bandages, you know. It's a good thing to do. One of the other people that I did 40 masks for is down close to St. Louis. They give out food to kids every day. So now their volunteers now have masks because they are around 350 kids a day handing them out. And that's also important to keep them safe, to get these kids fed. So even though it's not the medical field, it is somebody else out there who is helping to make a difference and to help, you know, keep kids going and keep them nourished during this period of time. I think all of that is important. And it's also important for us as individuals to wear masks. You don't know if you're a carrier or not. You don't want to make anybody sick. So if you have your mask on, then you know you're not going to get anybody sick. And if they have their mask on, then that also protects you. So as it takes a while to get used to them, but I think it is very, very important to do.
Last question. If someone is listening to this and is not sure if or what they can do to help out, what do you recommend?
Basically, if you want to make masks, just get on the Carl website. There's a site on how to do it, or look up CU Mask Makers on Facebook. They've got a spot. You know, go get somebody's groceries and wear your mask and gloves. you know, mow somebody's yard. Take somebody's dog for a walk. Call people, because this staying home is for the birds. I'm used to being able to go and I can't, and it's me and a dog. So there's a lot of things that people can do just in that vein alone. And if you can't do anything else, donate to a cause, you know, financially that can help people.
Sure.
Right now we're in probably one of the most difficult times that the United States has seen for years. And so be kind. That is the best thing anybody can do, is just be kind to people, wave at people. And if you can help them out, I took masks to each one of my neighbors just with a note, you know. It was a simple thing to do and it didn't take me a lot of time. So people can be creative and they can think of, oh, you know, there's my neighbor and, you know, the grass is kind of long. Maybe I'll just go over and mow it for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can do a lot of things.
We've been talking with Jean Huddleston of Champaign. She and a friend have made more than 800 masks for first responders and healthcare workers around Illinois. Jean, thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for calling. I appreciate it. And you have a good day.
You too, and stay safe. If you want to see pictures of the masks Jean has made, you can go to 21stshow.org. We'd also love to hear what you are doing to contribute to the COVID-19 efforts. Send us an email, talk@21stshow.org. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Many of us have been spending more time with our pets because of the stay-at-home order in the state, or even adding new pets to our households. That includes regular 21st show guest and Illinois Newsroom reporter Lee Gaines, who's fostering a cat named Remy.
Remy. This is Remy. He's about 6 months old, and he is white, but he's also got this like brown and black tabby pattern, and he weighs like, I don't know, 5 pounds. He's very sweet, very cuddly when he wants to be.
And our next guest is eager to let you know that Remy is available for adoption. Free to Shore is with CatSnap in Champaign. They trap and spay and neuter cats and also coordinate adoptions and fostering. Free to welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Thanks for being here. And also joining us from the Paws Humane Society in Rockford is Mike Flickinger, the shelter manager. Mike, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Mike, have you seen an increase in adoptions? I've seen a news story out of the Chicago area that they had basically, at least one shelter up there, had been emptied.
Yeah, we've been definitely seeing an increase in adoptions. We usually do roughly like 1 to 5 adoptions a day, pretty much. A lot of them have been more from like out of area adoptions from people in like Wisconsin and like from like the Chicago area or the suburbs.
And what about you, Frida? Same question. Have you seen an increase in adoptions at CatSNAP?
Slight increase. We're, because of the shelter in place, we are doing only adoption or only adoption by appointment, and we are a foster-based rescue. Mm. So it's a little different than an actual having a brick-and-mortar building. So we have to make appointments. We are excited, though. We are getting people interested. Actually, I'm meeting several people today with masks and gloves and the whole nine yards, and hoping we've got a few going home today.
Hmm. So you mentioned before the show that now is actually the time of year where you do a lot of cat rescues. Why is that?
Because this is the prime season for kittens being born.
Hmm. Okay.
The mating seasons, unfortunately, the last few years have been almost nonstop all year because of the weather. Most of the kittens are being born. We actually have numerous mothers and babies now, and it will just continue to get worse over the next 2 months.
So Mike, we heard Frida's talking about meeting people for adoptions with masks and gloves. How has your shelter up in Rockford changed its operations in response to COVID-19?
So we've stayed open. We don't have like regular business hours like normal, so not anybody can just walk in, but we're open by appointment only. So you would just like do the application online. Once you're approved, we'd set up a time for you to come in. We're doing one family at a time in our shelter looking at the cats. We've been doing, you know, extra sanitizing and sanitized stations more than we have before, making sure everything's sanitized in between, you know, the people coming in, as well as wearing gloves, you know, having gloves for the people to wear, and then trying to wear masks just to kind of contain everything.
And Frida, I understand you also help provide cat food for people who cannot afford to feed their pets. Why is it important to provide that for people, especially now?
Well, it's actually more so now. We've always tried to supply pet food to some of what we call our feeders for the feral colonies. But here recently, we've had a request from people that have been put, you know, are out of work due to the COVID shutdown. So we are trying very hard to help them with some cat food and even cat litter, anything that will be able to have those pets stay with their owners and not have to go to a shelter.
And Mike, I think we just heard Frida there saying about how, you know, a lot of people are out of work now. I wonder if with pet adoptions going up during a pandemic, are you worried about what will happen to pets, Mike, when everyone goes back to work?
We always have that, you know, of course, in the back of our minds, because, you know, you just never know. But we have a policy, and it's in our contract that, you know, if for whatever reason they can't keep the pet, they have to contact us, and then we take back, you know, the pet, no questions asked. So if worse came to worst, you know, they'd still have a safe place to go. But we hope that, you know, more often than not, that they'll, you know, keep their cats or kittens, you know, forever.
So can we end the week on sort of like a happy note? Do you have, Mike, a story about a cat or dog that's been adopted recently that can sort of leave us on a high note?
We had a cat named Lydia. She's about 3 years old, I want to say. She got adopted last night to somebody that I know that had lost one of their cats recently due to cancer. And Lydia had been with us since July of last year. So she was almost one of our longest residents, and it was really happy to see her finally find a home.
And Frida, I wonder, any last minute thoughts here? We've got about 30 seconds left in our conversation, but if people want to help your operation CatSNAP, what can they do?
We actually have an Amazon wish list, which they could go to Amazon, and the link is available on our Facebook page. That's an easy way without having to go out to the store. We are taking donations of like hard food, hard cat chow, and even litter. They just need to contact us via our email, catsnap@catsnap.org.
Okay.
And I love Mike's story. Yeah. Happy endings are wonderful.
That's right. And Mike, last question to you, about 15 seconds. If somebody wants to help your shelter in Rockford.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, what has already been said, we're always in need of donations. We do have a wish list on our website at pausehs.org, and we're always in need of more volunteers as well. And if anybody's interested, they can fill out a volunteer application on the pausehs.org as well, because we're pretty much primarily volunteer-based as well.
All right. Mike Flickinger is the shelter manager, shelter director at Paws Humane Society in Rockford. We also spoke with Frieda Shore, president of the volunteer organization CatSnap. And that, I'm afraid, is all the time we have for the 21st today and this week. You can always find a podcast of our show at 21stshow.org. Catch up with our old episodes. We're produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpesson's our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.